WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around to get updates on the latest stories happening right here in Chicago. But first, public libraries, they've kind of always been more than just buildings with stacks of books. And here in Chicago, that's especially true. Local libraries are showing up for community members in big ways. They serve as warming and cooling centers during extreme weather. They're your polling place. They can help you apply for jobs. And now a West Garfield Park branch is home to Chicago's first food pantry inside a library. We'll dig into how these longtime institutions continue to evolve and why they matter now more than ever. At the table was Chris Brown, Chicago Public Library Commissioner, Megan Greenback, Assistant Director of Legler Regional Library in Garfield Park, and Mary Davis Fournier, Executive Director of the Public Library Association, a division of the American Library Association. Megan kicked things off with more on how the Legler Library's food pantry got started.
So we have been partnered with the Greater Chicago Food Depository since 2021. We used to do what they called the Produce Mobile Program. So once a month, they would deliver fruits and veggies, and we would distribute it to our patrons. And then when that program was no longer available in our service area, they gave us the great opportunity to pivot into a full-fledged food pantry. And we knew we just had to jump at the chance.
Wow. And so the library pantry, it's open Thursdays and Sundays in the afternoons. Who's allowed to use it, and do they need their library card?
You do not need a library card. You don't even need an ID. It is open to anyone. We never turn away anyone who wants food. Our primary service district is zip code 60624, but like I said, we never turn anyone away. If you're hungry, you can come by.
And if you had to assess, how many people would you say use the pantry on average so
150
far?
Households a week are coming through on average.
And you're equipped to handle that
yes.
volume.
Yes, we are. Yeah. It's been a learning curve for sure, but we are equipped to handle that and more.
Chris, the city of Baltimore did this. They opened a food pantry inside a library back in 2024, so a couple of years ago. So it's true, though, that Legler is just the second food pantry. No one else in between has
just
jumped into this.
And fully functional food pantry.
So how did we get here?
I think libraries across the country, and especially in Chicago, we really think about our spaces as places to activate access, yes, for books, yes, for information, but also we have an incredible partnership with DCase. We have world-class art in every neighborhood, Sen Ra, Kerry James Marshall. Mm-hmm. We have a partnership with Chicago Public Health Department, so we have mental health clinicians in our libraries. We have Narcan access. We have partnerships with Young Chicago Authors, doing open mic nights. It's really an incredible space all throughout our city. We have 1.9 million square feet of space throughout Chicago's neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, and you just listed a lot of things, right? The warming and cooling centers, the Narcan. I know that in this week, at least, in advance of Bad Bunny's Super Bowl performance, libraries are exploring Puerto Rican history through music.
Yes.
Does it ever feel, though, like you're asking too much of your librarians?
I think it's a lot of what they've done throughout history, what they've done across the country. A lot of these are partnerships. So it's more about relationship building and looking at our assets and bringing folks in to activate and make those spaces vital.
Yeah. Mary, a lot of people thought the digital age would mean just the end of libraries. Talk to me about how you stay relevant.
Not quite.
Not at all.
Yeah, so libraries have always been places of equitable access to resources and lifelong learning and limitless exploration. So what that means, as public libraries, their main driver is access and response to community needs. So when it comes to, responding to needs in technology, to helping communities understand AI, that's, the big thing right now, or yes, access to any sort of resources, whether it's, signing up for ACH or, becoming a voter, access to, that'll be a, big national response in the coming months, making sure you have access to your rights as a voter. All of those things are what libraries are doing. Mm-hmm. They're responding to community needs.
And you're seeing this firsthand. You meet and work with librarians all over the country.
Oh my gosh, it's incredible.
So you're seeing some of the more innovative uses of the spaces.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, libraries were the first to come out with maker spaces, for youth and for adults, for the ability to apply for jobs as jobs, went digital, to have centers for small business development. Mm-hmm. So many things. I think they're actually all things that you also see, as Commissioner Brown was just describing, within the Chicago public system.
Yeah. And Commissioner, Northwest Side's Independence Park Library, I want to highlight that example of shared use, right? So in 2019, the new 16,000 square foot library opened up, and it was in a building with 30 units of affordable housing for seniors. Do you think that we'll see more shared use libraries like that?
We have a really exciting one coming up. So we're going to have the Obama Presidential Center, which will have the first public library branch in a presidential center. So already we know we're going to have a one-of-a-kind co-location later this summer.
Wow. And so I want to know what you hear from librarians across the country, Mary. Are they talking to you about some of the stressors that they're under in general? There's been so many things to deal with, book bans and such, keeping up with what you can, what you can't do. And then, of course, you're adding services for folks who are in need.
Certainly I think that librarians around the country, all library workers, with that mandate to respond to their community needs,
yeah,
they're so dedicated. They are, I think we saw, following the pandemic, especially the way libraries, made so many things accessible that were instantly, that had been cut off, access to wireless, to hotspots, to devices, mm-hmm, for, after school and in school learning. So many innovations came out there. But as Commissioner Brown just described, many of those things are through local partnerships. And that's really the key. And the library often is able to provide the space and the access and that first level of access to community and then go from there. So librarians have they're incredibly versatile.
Hug a librarian today if you see one.
I mean, really, it's not just, yes, please do support your libraries. They need you to go use your libraries. We need you to stand up for libraries in any public forum with your legislatures.
Megan, talk to me about some of the things that maybe you never thought would be part of your job description.
First and foremost, food pantry, for sure. I never anticipated that happening when I was in library school. But as Mary said, and as Commissioner Brown said, we're taught to assess community needs, and we're taught to how to turn those needs into responsive programming and services. And so that's what we've done here. And the reward is we have patrons coming in who are so grateful, who are discussing with us recipes that they're making from our food pantry, who are engaged with us in a new way that we haven't seen before. And that's all of the reward we need. It's really incredible how we're building community.
Yeah, I mean, and even just the fact you mentioned being taught to assess community needs. I mean, I would think that at the start of your career journey, that might not have been like the straightforward job description for a librarian, but you've had to just evolve with the times and what's happening and the library's quick response. Has that been easy?
I mean, I wouldn't say easy, but I think we're all rising to the challenge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nothing worth doing is really easy. So this is just a way that we're able to give back to our patrons, and they give so much to us. And I think at Legler, we do a really great job of having responsive programming across all areas. We have an artist in residency program. We have a maker lab specifically for our adult patrons, because that was a need we saw in the community. We saw a need for fostering creativity and entrepreneurship mm-hmm. that wasn't being met. So we stepped in to help with that. And the food pantry is no different. We are here for our patrons first and foremost.
Yes.
We are here to help people as best we can. And that way just happens to come through something really cool this time, which is food.
Yeah. And we know you can get, you can read in lots of different ways now online. But talk about why the physical space, Mary, of a public library still matters in today's world.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, so once again, communities are varied all over the country, right? There are small communities, rural communities, suburban, urban, and the universal truth there is that the library is a space that welcomes everyone, that is accessible. In so many places, the library is the after-school place. It is the free cultural institution in communities. There are fewer and fewer places that are free, where everything is free.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's a place to assemble, to convene, to connect. It is just, and there is much more, you know, I think we're seeing since the pandemic a return in so many ways to patrons, members of the community coming back to the physical space of the library because we miss it, right? Mm. Don't we all miss that interaction, face-to-face interaction in so many ways?
Oh, yes.
And libraries are such welcoming spaces for that.
What would you add, Commissioner, to the importance of the physical space?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why we get kind of these opportunities to connect neighborhoods with food or mental health resources is because it's such an inclusive space that people feel a sense of intellectual, psychological safety mm-hmm. being in them. And so I think that's a big part of it. It's a space that any voice can belong, any member of our public can belong. And so instead of just always going to a social service point, I think people just feel really welcome.
Yeah.
And that's why they're coming in.
And I imagine, though, there's some kind of push and pull there of making sure that the library is that welcome third space for different constituents.
Yep.
How do you do something? That's a big job to meet everyone's needs.
Yeah, I think we really try to figure out our lane. Like, we don't provide the social services, right? We don't directly, you know, stock the public health vending machine with Narcan material. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really like a partnership space that institutions dedicated to access work with us to stock and provide resources. I think you do bring up a really good point around that tension of, though, like, as you're an incredibly inclusive space, mm-hmm. what kind of proximity does that put your workforce into? And so we really try and support our staff on training and, you know, just what they need to just better navigate.
And additionally, on the same token, I mean, we are, as we've sort of alluded to, we're living in pretty polarized times, right? So what comes to mind is, you know, the potential impact for the librarians in terms of, like, which groups can hold events at the libraries at a given time. Is that something that comes up for discussion?
I think we're oftentimes like the go-to space. There's simply just not a lot of community public neighborhood space in every neighborhood. So, you know, when the mayor's Office of Community Safety wants to connect with youth during after hour and just provide safe late night activities, mm-hmm. they do it in the library. When Young Chicago authors want to connect in a neighborhood and do those open mics, they'll come into the libraries and offer them. So I think we're often that go-to space for community to come together and feel that it's theirs.
Yeah. Well, how do you think, Mary, if we look to the future, how might libraries change even more? You're continuing to evolve. What might the library, the Chicago Public Library, look like in a decade? dare you think
Chris,
that far.
Might the Chicago Public
well,
Library.
You know, Mary and her PLA team, they lead these convenings nationally, right? So every other year, they get all of our public library leaders together, and it's really that moment for us to share, you know, what are you doing? Where are you kind of advancing your agenda and your model of service? And so there's this really national dialogue to figure out, yes, what it could look like in Chicago, because we're very unique, we're very diverse, we're socioeconomically diverse. So it might look like more co-locations, it might look like more co-locations with retail and other community partners, but also we do a lot of that dialogue with our PLA partners and Mary and all of our library leaders across the country.
What other hats do you think you can wear in the next decade, Megan?
A lot of hats.
I can't wait to see,
We've had a lovely conversation about the many services that the Chicago Public Library provides. A great deal of credit, though, for being able to provide those services goes to the CPL Foundation. That group is dealing with a tragedy right now. The foundation CEO, Brenda Langstrat Bowie, died unexpectedly last Friday. And so our condolences not only to her friends and her family, but the many people within the Chicago Public Library system who benefited from her work and commitment to libraries.
Thank you.
And thank you all. My thanks to Chicago Public Library Commissioner Chris Brown, Megan Greenback of the Legler Regional Library, and the American Library Association's Mary Davis Fournier. Now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down was Cassie Walker-Burke, WBEZ's senior editor of arts and culture, Caitlin Washburn, Chicago Sun-Times reporter, and Claire Lane, WBEZ's morning edition anchor. Now it's been a week of weeks. Chicago Theater Week starts today, Chicago Restaurant Week runs through Sunday, and Black Restaurant Week kicks off on the weekend. So here's Cassie trying to help us keep track of it all.
You know, I don't think there's more, but I think what we're seeing is that they're running longer. And part of it is just, you know, they find, the organizers are finding that people are really responding to these. We're also in a little bit of an arts crisis. And so we're seeing that these are a great way to kind of bring people in, get butts in seats. And I think give people a chance to sample things they might not usually be comfortable with. Like this is, or maybe a new theater or like a restaurant that they want to try, but the lower price point helps get them in the door.
Yeah, and I should correct myself. Chicago Restaurant Week's been happening, right? I went to a restaurant last night, took part. Not my favorite, I will say, time of year. Wow, two of you thrown back in your seats in shock.
Bold.
No, not in shock at all. Actually, I think that that's right. I think that it doesn't necessarily mean a deal doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be something that you want, but I think it's something you can try.
Right, for sure.
Putting
I
down
love
too much money.
The concept. I'm just, I felt like I... It was in and out. It was just a lot of people because of all the buzz.
Swarmed.
And it was, I think they were overwhelmed. So I'm thinking of the folks who work there. It was just a lot.
I think that's part of the fun, too, is people get to sort of play critic. You know, you're like looking at the menu. There's the cocktail of Restaurant Week, right? Mm-hmm. There's the rotating bottle of wine. I mean, and you sort of get to take on a different kind of persona if you're into that kind of thing.
If you're into that, I think there's also, though, it's a prefix menu. And I think sometimes people don't realize when you go in that there's not going to be a lot of substitutions.
That's the
thing. So, for example, if you're a vegetarian, make sure before you go that there's a vegetarian option in each of the entree courses. Otherwise, you're going to be sitting there for a round. And sometimes, you know, that's not very fun.
Yeah. I think maybe I need Chicago Restaurant Week 101 just to know how to navigate.
Well, there are 500 restaurants in it. That's a lot.
And you know about some good deals, Cassie?
There are some good deals. You know, I think that's what's interesting. Black Restaurant Week to me feels, there are 40 restaurants. To me, it feels a little bit more like it's smaller. It's a little bit more approachable. It also starts Sunday, so it gets you through the Valentine's Day stretch. So if you're looking for something, you know, I think there's some good deals there. And there are some restaurants that still have reservations that, for example, Mahari in Hyde Park just won a Banchet Award.
Yes.
And so that is an award that comes chefs
Best
recognize
neighborhood
their own
restaurant.
Chefs. Right. So there's I think that it feels to me a little bit more approachable. mm-hmm. perhaps.
Well, let's pivot to some other news here, Claire, because Jesse Jackson Jr., he's making headlines. What's going on?
Yes, he is officially on the campaign trail, so we're getting an idea of some of what he'll be running on or the political image that he's trying to shape to woo voters. This, as we know, after launching a pretty spirited primary bid for his old U.S. House seat. The Chicago Democrat says his perspective after, as we also might remember, serving prison time for campaign fraud. But he says that that actually makes him an ideal candidate at a time when voters have more or less accepted other politicians, namely the president of the United
right.
States.
So he's not shying away from the reason that he lost, you know, in his political career.
No, it's a theme of redemption that he's trying to weave through his comeback attempt. And as we know, this is in a largely black Democratic district that mm-hmm. he's running for.
All right, Caitlin, the Illinois primary, we're getting closer. March 17th is when it's happening. And today's a pretty big day for the folks like me who are pretty eager.
yeah. Today, early voting starts, and as well as vote by mail. Next week is another big day, the 12th. That's the day that the early voting site, two early voting sites downtown open. The Board of Elections has a super site every year, and mm-hmm. that opens. And then another... So then another important date is on March 2nd. All of the 50 ward early voting sites also open. So you got plenty of opportunities to start voting. You can still sign up to vote by mail. Mm-hmm. You can still register to vote online. You can also, up until election day, register to vote in person. And if you have any issues with your address or you're in a new precinct, you can handle that day of, or you can be ahead of the curve and start working on that now.
Yeah, nice. So the folks who want to get a jump on voting for the primary, they've got several options, it sounds like.
Yes, they do.
Cassie, tell us about a new photo exhibit. I hear it's pretty special, this one.
It is. It's at the Museum of Contemporary Photography, Ooh. Which is adjacent to or part of Columbia College, so it's going to be in the Loop. I think this is a little museum that maybe sometimes people don't know it, but in this moment of AI-altered images, I have to say I was staying up late last night looking at these AI images. Mm-hmm. This is such a refreshing, like, step out of the cultural course collision that we're on. the Museum of Contemporary Photography is celebrating 50 years, and this show is organized in different galleries throughout the decades. There is focus on Chicago works, such as Paul D'Amato, who is a well-known photographer here, and his photo series from Pilsen. But you can also find the work of Dorothea Lange, who was this incredible Depression-era photographer. And her work was gifted to the museum in the 1980s. And so that's how it is incorporated into this exhibition. So you can see Chicago neighborhoods, Chicago people, but you can also see this incredible national work that, you know what, honestly, we don't get to see enough.
Yeah, and so you can read more about that at suntimes.com, right?
You can, and you can see examples of the photography.
Beautiful pictures. Yes. Now, Caitlin, in a pivot here, you reported on a story that I want to get into. It's tough to hear, but we got to talk about it, right? It's about a substitute teacher with a long criminal history of abusing children, and they managed to pass a background check and work in a Chicago area Catholic school for over a year. Walk us through what we know.
Yeah, so last week, the Archdiocese announced that they fired this man, Brett Smith, after they learned about his background. And honestly, it's thanks to parents for Queen of Martyrs, a South Suburban Catholic school that learned about this man's past. And he has now since been charged locally. He was charged in Orland Park and Evergreen Park last week, one felony count for sex abuse and then another battery charge. So that begged the question to me, how did he pass this background check? Which in their letter to parents, the Archdiocese said that he passed a state background check and fingerprint check. And the fingerprint check raised a question for me because they also said that he changed his name. In 2019, he changed his name. And the beauty of a fingerprint check is it'll follow you whether or not you change your name because it's tied to other IDs that court systems and corrections departments and in your social security number, can be tied to your fingerprint. So yes, you can change your name, but you can't alter this part of your record. So it turns out he has three past convictions for battery, which all of those convictions started as charges for more serious crimes for felony sex abuse, felony child molestation. And he had a pretty lengthy arrest record, too, in some cases where he was arrested and charged and the case was dismissed. But there's a record for this man going back to 2002. Sheesh. That should have raised some red flags.
Yeah, like, how did he get past all of these checks?
That's the big question.
That's the big question. And you tried your own, right?
Well, so yeah, how I found this was I was working on the story last week when the Archdiocese put the letter out. And as journalists, we have access to some public databases, like basically an advanced phone book. And I looked him up to give him a call, because that's what we do. If we're going to write about someone, we have to give them a chance to say their side. And when I looked up his name, both his old name and his current name, this big record came up. And from there, you know, I was able to go to publicly available court records, like the Cook County Circuit Court's website, and mm-hmm. then like records in other states too, in Indiana and Arizona. And that's where I found this pretty quickly, or at least found what would give someone pause and would be worth looking into.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very interesting story. Now, Claire, good news for the Chicago man who was accused and acquitted of putting a bounty on Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino.
Correct. So a federal judge in Indiana has ordered the Trump administration not to deport this man. U.S. judge, this is James Hanlon, said it's likely that Juan Espinoza-Martinez is entitled to a bond hearing that could lead to his release, so mm-hmm. he should not be deported because of that. Espinoza-Martinez has been in federal custody since his arrest on those murder-for-hire charges back in early October. So although he was acquitted on the 22nd of January, he was quickly taken back into custody by federal immigration authorities.
Yeah. So does this mean he's out of the woods?
So attorneys filed a petition on Monday challenging his detainment, and the judge told the feds they have to respond by tomorrow afternoon. So we will have an answer for you then.
Well, something else I want to ask you about while you're here, Claire, is a headline that definitely caught my eye. I think it might have caught yours too. Illinois is considering a statewide ban on glitter.
Yeah, so the makeup, the popular makeup trend we all maybe are familiar with, being shiny, sheeny, yes. having that sort of sun-kissed glow, could be a thing of the past. We should note that this is a proposed statewide ban on glitter would only apply to personal care products. So things like makeup, okay. right? Nail polish, potentially.
Okay.
The proposed legislation aimed essentially at reducing the microplastics that are polluting our state waterways that you find in some of these products. So the legislation would ban the sale of any of these products that contain non-biodegradable glitter beginning in 2029. So if that's a thing you're wearing too and you don't care about the environment, stock up. Cassie recommended Target.
Lock up the slime kit. Lock up my daughter's slime kit.
Right. What other headlines are you following, Claire?
Yeah, so the opening ceremonies for the Winter Olympics we know are tomorrow, but preliminary competition actually began yesterday in some events like curling. But the U.S. Olympic women's hockey team, they are hitting the ice this morning. This will be a 9:40 a Central Time puck drop. Wow. And there are four Illinoisans on that team.
Amazing.
Four ladies, two vets, two sort of newbies, and they are taking on Czechia.
Representing the preliminary. Illinois.
9:40 this morning, puck drop. Don't want to miss it.
Nice.
Team USA.
Yes, go Team USA. Cassie, there's a new opera in Minnesota, and it's actually based on the life of a Chicago composer. So tell us more about My Name is Florence.
Well, Florence Price, you know, Chicago people may know her name now. She was the first Black female composer to have a symphony performed by a major orchestra, that was the CSO. But then she died in 1953, and there were decades that went by that people did not know her work, did not hear her work. And then in 2009, in an old vacation home, they found a bunch of her writings and her works. And so she's enjoyed a renaissance in her, you know, I guess after her death, mm-hmm. Ravinia's played her work. It's been performed even in Europe. But now there's an opera based on her life, and that actually premiered in Minnesota.
Yes.
And so we sent a reporter, and, you know, this opera is premiering at a time when there's so much happening in Minnesota around immigration enforcement. And the folks behind the opera had to decide, are we going to pause this thing we've been planning for years? Mm-hmm. Are we going to press on? They decided to press on.
Yeah.
And so the context, I think, is also really interesting just in this moment where we're seeing the Met in New York, we're seeing the Kennedy Center likely closing because Trump wants to close it for renovations. These are all places that incubate operas. Mm-hmm. And so the regional players, like the Players in Chicago, Minnesota Opera, these are going to have, I think, they're going to be punching above
this
their weight.
This is their moment, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, with these new works.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now if folks are looking for something to do this weekend, I hear your team is recommending an ice hike. And I'm looking at you, Caitlin, because I'm like, would you?
Recommend, strong word.
This is because of strong research. You all went out and did the ice hike.
Indeed, we sent a reporter out on a 10-degree day hike Matheson State Park, which is the smaller neighbor of Starved Rock, if you know it. And I think that in this moment, again, trying to get outside, get to the outdoors. Mm-hmm. The key, he says, is the right gear. But when you go out there, he was actually the only person in the park when he went on a Monday. And I think it was just a real moment of silent reflection for him. He wrote about it. We have incredible photos. We have an incredible video that's up. We sent two photographers to kind of retrace his steps a few days later. And but you can see all these incredible formations, icicles. It's really, you see nature in a completely different way.
Sounds
under the ice.
Beautiful. I just won't be joining them. But what about you, Caitlin? Is there hope? Ice hiking?
I'd be curious, but I would say Matheson is a great park. When you're feeling like the crowds at Starved Rock are a little much in the summer, I recommend Matheson. But okay. I'd be curious about an ice hike.
All right. Sign her up, folks. Caitlin Washburn, Chicago Sun-Times, and WBEZ's Cassie Walker-Burke and Claire Lane.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guthman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays. And once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening and have a great day.